Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Seb Stafford-Bloor from Tifo Football, and Adrian Clark, the tactical analyst. It's Punch and Judy time in the Premier League. Pep Guardiola speaks of a whispering campaign against Manchester City. Jurgen Klopp calls their successful appeal against the Champions League ban a bad day for football. Jose Mourinho, with a nod and a wink, suggests it's time to throw the circus doors open. Now, Jose, of course, knows all about creating a siege mentality. That's obviously on Pep's agenda. City stumbled against Bournemouth. But, Aid, do you expect them to make a statement against Arsenal in Saturday's FA Cup semi-final?
They'll be overwhelming favourites. Anyone that's seen recent meetings between City and Arsenal will realise that this has the potential to be quite a one-sided game, but they'll have to play better than they did against Bournemouth, won't they? That wasn't a stellar display by any stretch of the imagination, quite weak defensively. That said, they did make wholesale changes, of course. So look, yeah, that they have potential to rip anyone apart. I mean, the two previous games, of course, they won 5-0. Before that, they lost at Southampton. So look, As brilliant as we all know City can be, every now and again, they throw in a strange performance. Don't think they played poorly at Southampton, but they didn't find a way to break them down. So look, I don't think this is a game you can 100% call the outcome on ahead of kickoff. I think that Arsenal's victory over Liverpool, unusual how it was, will give them hope. But City will look to make a statement. They are pretty ruthless when it comes to domestic cup competitions. They love it, don't they? And look, with the potential All-Manchester final on the horizon, motivation, I would imagine, would be very high at Wembley.
Yeah, that's got to be a favourite, hasn't it, really? I suppose, Seb, City, look, you know, they're guaranteed runners-up place in the Premier League. And in a sense, it's almost like the third section of their season is just about to start. They've got some pretty easy Premier League fixtures, Watford away and Norwich at home. So probably that'll be the reserves and the kids, so they can concentrate on these knockout games. What do you expect from them?
Ruthlessness. In the FA Cup final, I think they, you know, that could be quite a humbling result for Arsenal. What I've seen from City is when they're dialed in mentally at the moment, their attacking play is so sharp, almost back to a level that it was at maybe a year ago. Their angle's a little bit fresher. Their possession play in the final third is really accurate. It just feels like there's so much more life to that attack. So I expect them to get through. I also expect them to win the final as and when they face most likely Manchester United. What a strange occasion that will be. Manchester derby in an empty stadium. That will be bizarre. And then the Champions League. I'm absolutely fascinated by what they do in the Champions League, because I think the Champions League this season is almost it's a conditioning war, isn't it, Mike? Because it's a lot of teams are, there's a couple of teams around Europe playing preparatory friendlies to get tuned up. Paris Saint-Germain are obviously one of those sides. Bayern Munich's fitter season has finished. We're in that old situation almost when you used to play a Russian side when their season didn't quite align with the rest of Europe. So that's really interesting. But City, I really like what I see at the moment from them. Bournemouth aside, and I think that's forgivable because they had their eyes on the FA Cup and they've got nothing left to play for in the Premier League. But it's really interesting. I think they're in as good a nick as any team around the continent at the moment.
Yeah, well, you know, pretty much was what we got what we pretty much expected against Bournemouth in terms of the defensive frailties. You know, you had Otamendi being squared up, Stones being unconvincing. The point was made during that game that, you know, Pep, because of his success at clubs, has never had any real experience of rebuilding a team. Now, is that what he's going to have to do over the next sort of, well, obviously the duration of his contract, another year or so?
That's a good question. I think a rebuild of sorts would reinvigorate him. He's had a little rebuild behind the scenes, hasn't he, with Mikel Arteta leaving and him bringing in a coach that he's got great respect for. So that's a new era within the confines of the dressing room. I think that if he is ruthless, and I'd imagine he will be this summer, then he will have a cull in defence and add the players that they need to kick on. I don't think they need to change too much going forward. I really don't. As Seb said there, some of the angles, some of the football is sumptuous. It really is. And obviously David Silva is going, but Foden is 100% ready to step into his boots. So no, I wouldn't envisage massive changes at the top end of the pitch, but surely this is the time to reboot the back four. And if he does that successfully, then City will be a massive threat to everybody next season. It really is going to be fascinating to see how Pep approaches it. It does feel from the outside looking in that the fire is well and truly back in his belly, doesn't it? I mean, this whole UEFA case has certainly got the juices flowing for him. He's coming out swinging left, right and centre and taking swipes at people. And I imagine that he's looking forward to serving up some big defeats in the coming months to some of those rivals.
What do you think about that sort of managerial spat, Seb? Is it just an extension of modern tribalism, something aimed at the fans? Or did all three of them who got involved in the argy-bargy have some valid points to make?
Yeah, I mean, let's be careful here. Obviously, I'm pretty aware of the legal issues that surround this. Yeah, I mean, I've heard what all three have said and I've agreed with certain aspects of it. Guardiola's little victory lap was a little bit strange to me. I didn't like it. I find him, every now and again, quite a strange press conference presence. He's got a sort of a bit of a chip on his shoulder. He doesn't like any situation in which he's questioned. He almost has a gear of, I'm not even sure how you describe it, but he sometimes lacks a bit of humility. And I felt his comments, without passing judgment on the case as a whole, that's not what I'm doing, I felt his comments weren't really appropriate in that context. Mm. I have a little bit of a hard time accepting Manchester City as a kind of hard done by underdog, with their army of players earning £200,000 a week and more. I also don't think it's, given the kind of the information that's been released and the nature of the investigation and the reasons behind the verdict that was delivered on Monday, this sort of crowing proclamation of innocence and demanding of apologies, yeah, I'm not sure about that.
No, I agree.
I thought it was ugly, Aid. Do you know what I mean? Like, look, Jose Mourinho is being mischievous. I think Jose Mourinho has been quite disingenuous with his remarks. He knows full well what the difference is between innocence and guilt. I found Jurgen Klopp to be a sort of a more sympathetic voice, and I sort of nod along to what he says. I don't think it's particularly good news for the sport of football. So I don't think Guardiola should be sort of basking in the outcome, really.
For sure. No, I thought what Klopp said was absolutely fair enough. What I like about it is that he wasn't scared to say it.
Yeah.
And that's quite a big statement to make. And he also managed to get a little bit of mind games in there saying, well, I'm happy because, you know, if they'd have had 10 or 12 fewer games, it would have been tougher for us to defend the title. So, no, I thought his response was fair enough, but it will rile Pep Guardiola, no doubt about
it. Guys, I mean, let's be fair. Guardiola says nothing by accident, nothing. Everything he says is thought out. And
To be honest, that's an aspect of modern management.
Yeah.
Most, because they are all conditioned to, you know, periodic trial by press conference, they're either going to say nothing, which is, you know, usually the default position. You know, they'll just wibble on about anything.
The Pellegrini approach, yeah.
Well, that sort of thing. But yes, you're right, because, you know, famously, Mourinho has, you know, traditionally used press conferences as part of the pre-match strategy.
Yeah, and press officers these days are often like barristers, aren't they? You know, warning the gaffers of what's to come when they take the stand and what they should say and what they shouldn't say. I do think that these elite coaches have their own minds, though, and I think it's very difficult to stop Klopp or Mourinho saying what they want to say. But yeah, they're well prepped for these things, And they don't say them because journalists have wound them up necessarily. They go into these conferences knowing full well what they want to say and what they want to get out there. So look, for me, it's good because it spices things up a little bit. It's been a very one-sided title race. We've missed that, haven't we? We're missing the adrenaline of having supporters in the ground. So a little bit of managerial rivalry, some you know, harsh words here and there. I think it's all good.
Yeah. In that context, Seb, is there any significance in Liverpool now not being able to reach 100 points and emulate or exceed City's achievements?
I mean, whether they see any significance in not getting that record is really up to them. I'm not quite ready just to wave this away as a sort of a you know, post-championship blues. I think quite obviously the attitude has drained away and the application is not what it was, and that's obviously a considerable factor. But I think also it'd be naive to say that what we've seen over the last few weeks from Liverpool is suggestive of a squad which needs a little bit of work. So I don't think that the animating factor will be the record. I think it will be the level of performance. I think if, you know, the cameras have been trained on Jurgen Klopp, they were last night for the loss at Arsenal, but also the draw with Burnley. He wasn't happy. This isn't a manager just sitting there, you know, inviting his players to do what he wants, because if that's what he was after, he would be loading his team with Harvey Elliott and and players like that. He would be making team selections which suggested that he was indifferent. He's annoyed. And I think, you know, some of the players that exist beneath this first team, for me, they're not quite good enough to be there. I don't think Shaqiri is good enough to threaten any of those Liverpool front three. I'm not quite sold on Minamino. Quite like him as a footballer. I think he's very neat and tidy, and you know, there's things to like about him. But is he someone that's going to tweak a player ahead of him in the pecking order to a greater level of performance? No, because he's not going to be a first teamer.
I tell you what, this run of form for Liverpool, this mediocre spell, I think will force Jurgen Klopp to bring in at least one big name signing.
Yeah,
I don't think he wanted to. I don't think that he wanted to tinker with it because he's got a great formula. It's all working very nicely. They're very special league champions. But what he's seeing in terms of attitude or just an easing off, and the point that you just made is most relevant there, the substitutes aren't putting enough pressure on the big boys. That we know Liverpool's best 11. It's there for all to see. I think we could all name it. And what Klopp has to do now, in my opinion, is bring in one or two players that would genuinely threaten guys that are in that starting 11. And that, I imagine, will lead to a rise in standards again. Every dressing room needs a new face each season, in my opinion, just to get the juices flowing again and to remind them that nothing should ever be taken for granted.
We're taking for granted, this is just the thought that's popped into my head, we're taking for granted the fact that Manchester United are going to sign at some point, at some price, Jadon Sancho. What about Liverpool taking control of that situation?
Have they got the finances there, Mike? I mean, if for that kind of transfer, is that achievable? Also, I mean, it's interesting because there's definitely a compromise between making the kind of signing which provokes improvement and then making the kind of signing which disrupts a group which has been really successful. Mm. Because
yes,
if Sancho comes in, let's play a hypothetical here. Sancho comes in, you're paying 100 million quid for him. He's not sitting on the bench. So someone's getting dropped to accommodate him. Now, what is the ripple effect of doing that? So if, for instance, you're saying that he's going to take Mohamed Salah's place, how do the players that have played around Salah for the last couple of years respond to that? He's got presumably friends in the dressing room. He is someone that deserves an awful lot of credit for what Liverpool have achieved. So what are the repercussions of doing that? I think it's one of the things that gets misunderstood. It's a really sensitive process because you're dealing with team chemistry issues. You're dealing with a dynamic that doesn't just exist on the pitch. You're potentially creating cliques away from the club. You know, who does Mohamed Salah spend time with when he's not at training or not at games? You introduce a Sancho, who isn't someone that's going to challenge for a position. He's going to take a position, and that's an entirely different, well, tank of sharks, kettle of fish, whatever. I mean, it's difficult. It's a hard thing to manage.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, you know, It's interesting to throw this over to you, Aid, and from an Arsenal perspective, I thought it was very significant after the game last night that Mikel Arteta, in essence, was saying to his board and his owners, show me the money, wasn't he? He was saying, look, I need to, I'm worried that we haven't got the financial resources to do the sort of rebuild that we need. Is that a potential pinch point?
Well, he's right, first and foremost, and I'm glad that he said it. I think that he was waiting for the question, and once that question arrived, there's absolutely no way that he wasn't going to confront the issue. It was good because there was no gloating from Arteta. He was saying, look, we've won tonight, we've shown good fight and character, but we are a million miles away. I mean, he showed the gap with his arms, didn't he? And it was, and it's true. We could all see it and we all know it. And Arsenal have fallen behind standard wise. So he, as a coach, is laying the gauntlet down to the club, the powers that be within Arsenal, to say, are you going to back me? Do you have the ambition to catch up a team like Liverpool? Yes or no? Simple as that. And he and we are about to find that out, aren't we? We know that Arsenal don't want to spend a lot of money this summer. We're told that they don't have a great deal available. But with an owner like Stan Kroenke, I think that who has spent vast sums on some of his other franchises of late, in particular a new stadium, there is the firepower there if they wish to use it. So this is going to be really telling, and Arteta, I sense, won't be satisfied until he gets that back in. And I would be the same in his shoes, because this is a huge job for Mikel Arteta. It's his first job as a manager, and if he isn't given the support and it turns out that it's not a success, where does he go from there? So I think he's right to flex his muscles. And look, this is Arsenal. This is a team that in terms of size and fan base around the world, they are one of the biggest clubs around. They have to show that ambition, in my opinion, and give the manager better quality players.
At the risk of stating the obvious here, Seb, high level recruitment is a specialised and very difficult business. Now, if you look, you know, Arsenal have been linked quite consistently with Thomas Partey. Now, Atletico look to have bought his loyalty, if you like. Mm-hmm. They look to have doubled his money. Now, that's the sort of blow which come, you know, they've got to ride those sort of punches. Are you confident that the way that the system works at Arsenal, in terms of, you know, it basically drove Sven Mislintat away from the club because of the way they wanted to do their transfers, is it going to be a critical weakness for Arsenal?
Well, at the moment, I mean, I don't know about critical weakness, but I mean, I'm not reassured by their recruiting activity because I don't fully understand the dynamic. I understand the existence of the committee. So my, and please, Adrian, jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that the club makes the decision on which players, which positions they want to strengthen. The transfer committee, which includes the voice of Mikel Arteta and the various scouting bodies at the club, then make a decision on the identity of the players pursued. But there's all sorts of unanswered questions. What is the role of the sort of the lapsed analytics department at the club, which was, you know, bought back in, I think, 2011 for a great deal of money and has sort of had its head chopped off with Jason Rosenthal going off to FIFA to work with Arsene Wenger? What is the role of Raul Sanlihi? What is the role of Kier Drabchin? Yeah, what is Arsenal's process? It's weird that I don't understand.
Edu as well. Edu is another name. He's the sporting director, of course. So yeah, you'd imagine it's Edu, Raul Sanlihi, and Mikel Arteta primarily that would sit around a table and discuss targets. But look, it's absolutely imperative that you can't marry yourself to one agent and just take all of their clients. It's very, very important that you target the right players, the right characters, to fit Arteta's philosophy and dressing room. So Arteta has to drive it, in my opinion. And if he's not allowed to drive it, and I don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but if he isn't allowed to drive it, then it's really unfair on him as a head coach. And I think that's important to recognise. He is a head coach and not manager at Arsenal, which I think will just chip away a little bit at him, because he has very fixed ideas, I imagine, Mikel, on the types of players that he needs.
Aid, let me ask you a question. Suddenly he is head of football. Edu Gaspar is sporting director, and Mikel Arteta is obviously head coach. Now, in the summer, what do Arsenal need? Probably, for the sake of argument, let's say at least one centre-half and probably a defensive midfielder. Now, whose is the dominant... Who casts the deciding vote at the club? If I'm head coach and I want a defensive midfielder with attributes X, Y, and Z, what's the weighting of my opinion in that room? Like, because to me, from the outside, Eddie's role and San Leahy's role, they clash a little bit. Because ordinarily, I'm used to the idea that a sporting director answers to a chief executive or an owner, and their job performance depends on a symbiosis with the head coach. But this is a bit more muddled. It's a little bit more convoluted. And as a result, I don't really understand the dynamic.
No, I don't think any of us do, unless you're within the confines. All I'll say is that I think that the head coach should always have the final say. Now, that doesn't happen, we know, at many, many clubs. But for the health of any football team, and actually for the well-being of the players recruited, you should only want to join a club if that manager is sold on you.
Exactly.
And if Arsenal recruit a player that Mikel Arteta doesn't really want, then that's a problem from word go. So let's hope that's not happening.
Well, there are some signs of impending change anyway, isn't it? It looks like Maitland-Niles might be moving on. And the one thing, Aid, that you can't criticise Arteta for is a lack of conviction in some of his decisions. And I'm thinking here of Mesut Ozil. With Ozil, could he become almost the new Gareth Bale in essentially not needing to move due to his huge contract?
Yeah, I understand the comparison. And look, officially he's got a back injury, although I believe he did put something out on social media yesterday saying
he's ready.
Ozil, will he stick around? I think that would be the negotiating tool, you know, on his part. I think he realises that Arsenal are looking to probably move on from Mesut Ozil, but he's also acutely aware that he's owed a lot of money between now and the end of the contract. And footballers, you know, since the beginning of time have been prepared to sit tight, haven't they, and see out their contracts. So look, some kind of negotiation has to happen here, and there has to be someone that's willing to take Mesut away from Arsenal as well, doesn't there, for that change to occur. And it has to be a place where he is comfortable going to. It's an uneasy impasse, isn't it? And I really, really hope for Mesut's sake and for Arsenal's sake that they can come to some kind of agreement in the coming weeks, whichever way it turns out. If it's we're going to reintegrate you into the squad and play you, fine. Or if it's time's up, we're going to move you on and here's X amount of money to make that happen, then for the greater good, I think Arsenal probably need to make some kind of financial sacrifice to free up the spot for someone younger, hungrier, and hopefully just as talented.
Yeah, I've been reading John Cross, friend of the show, this morning, you know, his match report from last night. And, you know, he made the point that Pepe was essentially the invisible man. Mm. Again, is that something, you know, is that looking like another £72 million mistake?
No, I don't think so necessarily. I think that Pepe has been a bit of a form player. He was anonymous in the game against Liverpool, but it was a weird game. I mean, Arsenal made, you know, hardly had the ball after half time. But he was also played in a position on the left, which he certainly doesn't like. He's a right-sided player that comes in on his left. I think that's all really he's got. So no, it's too early to say it's been a mistake, I think. But for the money spent, I wouldn't say that he's delivered quite as much as Arsenal were hoping.
He's like you know what he's like. He's like an instrument in an orchestra that nobody has quite got in tune yet. Like, because I think he's a seriously talented footballer.
Yeah.
It's just like they haven't worked out how to use him and how to extract the most. And also, you know, guys, let's be fair, a year into life in a new league, he wouldn't be the first player to have a serious conditioning issue. You know, we see that all the time. I think you can easily see 2 or 3 years' time him being a really destructive wide forward.
look at the goals that Nicolas Pepe has scored this season. And, the efficiency when he drops the shoulder, comes in onto his left foot and bends it into the far corner. If he can just produce that on a more consistent basis, he can be an unstoppable force. But he needs to have a role within the team that he understands. And I don't think that they've reached that point yet. And also, and I think this is absolutely crucial, Arsenal sorely miss a creative player. Since Mesut Ozil has come out of the side, either through form or other factors, they don't have a chief orchestrator. They don't have someone to unlock the door too often. I was looking at the stats ahead of last night's games. Pepe and Saka are the two most creative players in the team in terms of creating quality chances. And neither are anywhere near the top creators in the Premier League. So I think once Arsenal bring in the right player to fit that mould, it could help to unlock Pepe. But right now, he hasn't settled. I think that's fair to say.
Okay, let's look at Sunday's FA Cup semi-final, if we may. Manchester United, they're at Crystal Palace on BT Sport tonight. Do you think their next season's Champions League place, first of all, is likely to come down to that final match at Leicester?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's a fascinating game. I'm really looking forward to seeing how Leicester respond to what happened to them at Bournemouth. I mean, I think it'll be very interesting, very descriptive of Brendan Rodgers' management. But yeah, there's no getting away from it. That equaliser against Southampton hurt Manchester United. I wouldn't read too much into the result itself because I just think it was a very, very well-worked set piece and Southampton played very well. I don't think we need to be too reactionary. But for the sake of the short term, that leaves them, not in control of their own destiny, potentially. So I still think that Manchester United, I might be informed by what happened when Ole Solskjaer first turned up at the club. It still feels to me as if they are riding momentum. I wonder whether this is a permanent state, this kind of free-form, expressive, uninhibited Manchester United. Whereas that is, I wonder whether that's a kind of a truth now. And Southampton, it was interesting. It doesn't make me change my opinion on Solskjaer for better or worse. But I still think it showed that they're not quite a finished work. That there are still things in the game. There are still tactical approaches that they can come up against, which they're going to struggle to play. And there were some cracks as well. Pogba losing the ball on the edge of his own box. Bruno Fernandes was not particularly influential. All of that sort of attacking fluency wasn't quite there again. Maybe it's fatigue. Maybe it's a sign of these very strange times with the high volume of football, more than possible. But it's very, very interesting. And nothing's going to be settled before that Leicester game, Mike. Put it that way.
Just throwing it at Sunday, do you think the pace of movement that United have shown recently, Aid, is likely to be too much for Chelsea?
It could be. It depends on the approach from Chelsea. I'd imagine that they will look to control the game and through possession, because we know that that's Lampard's way. The issue, of course, is that can leave you vulnerable to breakaways, and that's where United are at their best. Interestingly, the recent win against City was the tactics were flipped around, and Chelsea actually were pretty destructive themselves on the break, weren't they? So maybe that performance has given Frank Lampard something else to think about, and in terms of the way that they go about their business. I suspect we might see a slightly more cautious Chelsea performance because Frank can't trust his defence at the moment. Well, he doesn't trust his defence. I think that much is clear after what happened at Sheffield United. So he might just sort of sit there and say to Manchester United, all right then, what have you got in terms of breaking us down? And then we'll break on you via Pulisic, via Willian, etc. It's a really, really interesting matchup because I see flaws in both teams, but also great quality, particularly in the wide forwards. So hard one to call this.
Yeah, I'm sure, Chelsea are obviously conscious of the difficulty of their last two league games. They're at Liverpool and home to Wolves. Did you read anything at all into that Labour performance against Norwich earlier in the week?
Not really. I mean, to be honest with you, Mike, I think football at the moment it's kind of a warning about the dangers of burnout. These players look so tired. I mean, if you watch, I was watching the Newcastle Spurs game last night. Players were too tired to even celebrate the goals. And I think that Chelsea Norwich game was just, you know, Chelsea needed to win it. And that was it. There was nothing else to play for. Norwich are relegated. Norwich are not a Premier League football team by any measure at the moment. And it was a knackered favourite doing exactly what they had to do.
With that, Seb, you know, I found it very interesting that Dean Smith came out today and basically talked about the impact of players not being able to go into, you know, cryotherapy chamber for the normal, you know, for the layman, you know, the ice treatment, as it were. That was, I thought, a very good point.
Absolutely. I was actually having a conversation with someone yesterday on social media about recovery in general. And he was talking about sort of exactly that players are being denied the usual recovery procedures. But also he was sort of saying, well, you know, why aren't managers rotating their players? And I was like, well, it's hard, isn't it? Because all the imperatives are there for a side like Chelsea, for a side like, you know, for a manager like Frank Lampard. You've got top four on the line. You're not assured of it. So the idea that you can just rotate in eight players for the sake of sort of short-term conditioning measures, it's a little bit fanciful, isn't it? So it almost puts these teams in an unwinnable situation. And yeah, I don't think, I mean, in time, long feature articles are going to be written about what life was like inside the bubble. For now, you have to imagine that the oddity of the situation and players being denied all the luxuries that they're afforded when they have to recover for short turnaround, that's hugely significant.
Yeah, I think United are going to make changes for the semi-final. I think that they kind of have to because of the continuity of the starting 11 has been a strength, but we saw them against Southampton, that 11 just running into a brick wall. I think Fred will play, maybe McTominay, Daniel James, I think might come back into the side. We could even see Ighalo leading the line. I think that as far as United are concerned, the FA Cup is priority number three right now. I really do.
Well,
he made eight
changes in the last round, didn't he?
Yeah, exactly. I think Europa League, they have got a golden chance to win the Europa League, which of course gets them Champions League football anyway, if they were to muck up via the Premier League. I just feel that those are the absolute priorities. The FA Cup, I don't think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer will be as bothered about it as Frank Lampard.
Good old Jose again. He was talking about winning the Europa League is like Lewis Hamilton winning in Formula 2.
Wasn't it? What about all those fingers that he kept putting up when he won the Europa League? I mean, he didn't put up half a finger, did he? He put up a whole finger.
He counts the Community Shield as a trophy, for goodness sake, doesn't he? I tend to accept the logic of what Aid said there, that actually United will have the Europa League as a priority. Potentially they've got Wolves in a semi-final, haven't they? That'd be a spicy one.
Yeah, and I would really like Wolves across two legs. I think Nuno's the better manager. Also, you know what, I really like Daniel Podence, potentially, I don't know. He looks a really good player. I saw him play against Burnley last night. He looks a fantastic player. But I Wolves are my dark horse for the Europa League. I think that their progress and their ability to balance the Europa League with a Premier League season, you know, before lockdown happened, before the coronavirus, I think that's one of the sort of the biggest stories of the year, because it was their first attempt at doing that. We know how teams have struggled. We know the drop off that potentially can happen. And they've really adjusted to that burden well with a very, very small squad. I think they've only used, I think it's 19 or 18 outfield players in the Premier League this season. And the bulk of those, I think the bulk of the minutes have been shared around really 12 or 13 outfield players. So it's awfully impressive. And I quite like Wolves. I think over two legs that they would, they're quite suited to beating a team of Manchester United's profile. So that'd be interesting.
I just want to dwell a little bit, if we could, on the protection of young players. And I mentioned that in the context of Ramer's challenge on Mason Greenwood when United played Southampton. Now, that was overlooked by VAR. And if that's going to happen, what's the point of it all? Because, you know, that to me just screamed that the whole system, the refereeing, needs shaking up.
Yeah, if Stockley Park doesn't undergo a major reform this summer, then it will be negligent. We need to see, I think, a change at the very top. I think we need to see a change in policy that might be forced on them by FIFA. And I think we need to see a raft of changes in terms of who referees in the elite group, because what we've seen in recent weeks is shameful, really. The decision making from the VAR studio has been calamitously bad. And it just outlines, these are people that are not having 50,000 people screaming at them. It's not a rash decision. Yes, they're under pressure. They've got a minute, 90 seconds to make a call. But the judgment of our top flight referees in terms of fouls and penalty decisions has been woeful. I'm surely we all agree on that. And I just think it's time to give the next generation of match officials a chance, because I think at least 8 to 10 of these guys aren't up to it.
I think back to that day last summer when I went down to Stockley for the sort of the induction that we got and the kind of the introduction into, you know, how the system works. I'd say 50% of the people I met were great and very helpful and very interesting. The other half were obscenely arrogant. And the way that they answered questions, we were in a group with a few journalists and a few supporters, you know, who represented their supporters groups. And they talked to us like little children, you know, the concerns that we voiced and the questions we had. It was very much a kind of, it'll be fine, we know best, we're the Premier League, it's okay. And I think about that sometimes, because I think that sort of the thing that Stockley could benefit most from is probably a little bit of humility. You know, I have issues with the way they communicate, the way that they communicate. They'll only really communicate when the facts are on their side. You hear nothing from them when they're wrong, really, until quite recently. We've also had several changes, several unofficial changes to the clear and obvious definition. Whether it's acknowledged or not is absolutely untenable to claim otherwise. It's that has happened very clearly across the course of the season. So you've got to kind of, I think the mentality has to be adjusted. This is not a body that is impervious to judgment. And that's I think that if when that changes, then I think you'll see a lot of other healthier changes follow.
What I would do, Mike, is remove all Premier League refs from Stockley Park. I don't know. I mean it. I mean it.
What about having like recently retired referees in?
Well, oh, I see.
You just need people who can draw the line of where the offside is and whatnot, and you need the technical people there to see what's right and wrong. But on these penalty calls, then it should be down to the match official. You just need someone to say, yeah, this one you need to have another look at. But issue solved. And if the referees are on the pitch, go to the monitors and then make bad decisions, then just as it's always been, you just question that person. But right now, what's happening, because the decision-making process is so inconsistent and so bad sometimes, it is creating conspiracy theories. And I really don't like those conspiracy theories. I don't think there's anything in them. I just think it's poor judgment. We need the next generation to be given a chance. These people are proving that they don't understand. I don't understand football.
There's sort of a case for saying that we need to regulate the amount of time spent on some of these decisions. Because I think Adrian hit on a really good point there, in that it's breeding conspiracy theories. And one of the things that does it is this tendency that VAR has of the referees at Stockley. They can spend 3.5 minutes looking at something, and then you'll see something egregious go on that barely gets a second look. I think that the Romeo tackle on Green was a disgrace. Yes. And I, look, I it's just an instinct. I know. I personally believe that. There's no defense for not seeing that. I mean, even in real time, everyone recognised that as an appalling tackle.
Yeah, I think it's a cultural issue, and it's probably also, to be fair, a human reaction where a referee would think not once, not twice, but probably 3 times about making a call that would make one of his peers and maybe one of his friends look a bit daft. So I get that. I also get the fact that FIFA might weigh in on this situation, but I also believe that the Premier League should have the power to make their own judgment calls. Now, I'm thinking here on the 5 subs rule. I'm against it because it's you know, it entrenches elitism. The bigger clubs will be advantaged by it. But should the Premier League say, well, OK, if we're going to have five subs, let's introduce a law that maybe two of those who come on have to be academy graduates or under 21. How can we best game the five subs rule, do you think, guys?
That's not a bad shout. I mean, it seems my initial instinct is, oh, that's a bit complicated. But in terms of, I suppose it's a form of quota, isn't it? And we've talked before about you know, the need to get homegrown players, England players into the match day squads. That is one way of doing it, isn't it? We've seen it in the EFL where a certain amount of academy players have to be in the match day squads. Yeah, that's one way. It might make it slightly more palatable. I don't have as much of an issue with five subs as some people. I don't think it's necessary. I'd have a much bigger problem with tactical breaks becoming a thing. Let's just hope and pray that doesn't come in.
I think that's absolutely nailed on.
It's advertising space. It's inventory. Of course, it's going to happen. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a sad day for football because it changes football. It's always been two halves of 45, and I mean, is there a football fan out there that says, you know what football needs to improve? It's going to four quarters. That's what football needs to be a better spectacle. I just don't think anyone has ever said that. So, yeah, it would be not being done for the right reasons.
Yeah, there'll be a double jeopardy situation there. For a fan, when they're eventually allowed back in the stands, if you've got a drink stroke tactics break, have you got enough time to dive into the bar to get yourself a beer?
But player welfare, you know how it will be dressed up as player welfare, the same as the five subs rule. It will be, we're protecting players, the fixtures, the demands on players are so high, we need to give them these breaths and rehydration breaks. That's how it will be dressed up. But yeah, we know the truth.
Okay, to wind things up, really. Thoughts for the day, chaps. Seb, anything you'd like to tell us about?
Somber note, guys. I want to extend my best wishes to Serge Aurier and his family. I can't imagine how difficult it would be to play professional football in front of a global audience after your brother has been murdered. I mean, I'm reticent to say I'm full of admiration because it seems like I'm trivializing the issue. I'm trying to make it a kind of, you know, always got the heart to come out and play. I think it's amazingly difficult. And I one of my bugbears is the lack of compassion in the game. I don't think we show enough care and consideration for people who suffer personal traumas, players, for managers, for coaches, whoever else. Yeah, and I've got no agenda, just very best wishes because he's someone that's taken a lot of criticism. He's someone that for various reasons exists in a spotlight, but obviously that's an unspeakable tragedy that's occurred, and you know, hopefully his family are coping well.
Yeah, I thought, you know, we've given Jose Mourinho quite a bit of stick on this program, but I thought he actually handled it terrifically well.
Yeah, I agree. I agree completely. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Well said. And yeah. No. Exactly. Look, Jose Mourinho. We might not rate him anymore, but he's still, you know, he's still a decent person, and he's got. Yeah, certain values that are absolutely spot on with him. And Serge, yeah, I think sometimes it's the easiest thing to do is actually to distract yourself and get out there and play. But yeah, well done to him. Well done to all concerned. But yeah, it's an awful situation.
Okay. What do you want to talk about?
Well, it seems trivial by comparison. But Jordan Pickford has come into my head. I think he is at a crossroads moment in his career. The next three games are absolutely massive for Jordan Pickford because Carlo Ancelotti has come out fairly openly and been critical of Jordan Pickford's performance levels. He says he's not got enough competition. And I just sense that how he performs between now and the 27th of July, when it's all done and dusted, could shape his future because Carlo Ancelotti, if he continues on this wobbly run, Ancelotti, I think, will buy a number one to replace him, and he will find himself looking for a new club. If he shines, if he can remind everyone how good he can be, then I think he'll be fine. So yeah, just keep your eye on Jordan Pickford. Villa at home, Sheffield United away, Bournemouth at home, huge games for him.
Yeah, because it does seem that their season is petering out a bit at Everton, doesn't it? For me, a thought struck me watching David Silva on Wednesday night. Now, here was one of the greatest players in the Premier League era, seeing out his City career in was pretty much an unreal vacuum. Now, if anyone deserves a farewell tour and to feel the warmth and the respect of the fans of all clubs, it's him. Now, I think it's fair to say we all agree that football without crowds is diminished. Some optimists are holding out hope that some fans will be allowed into grounds early next season. But let's pause for thought here. A scientific study this week concluded that going to a sports stadium in a pandemic represents a 9 out of 10 risk. A return to even a semblance of normality is something that can't be rushed. Sad to say, it looks as if we will be into the new year before that happens. In the meantime, keep the faith. And thanks once again for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.